Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. In 1990, President George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act into law. It marked the world's first comprehensive civil rights law for people with disabilities. President Bush, flanked by two Americans in wheelchairs, compared the ADA to the fall of the Berlin Wall, which had happened a year earlier. And President Bush said this.
And now I sign legislation which takes a sledgehammer to another wall, one which has for too many generations separated Americans with disabilities from the freedom they could glimpse but not grasp. And once again we rejoice as this barrier falls, proclaiming together we will not accept, we will not excuse, we will not tolerate discrimination in America.
Fast forward three decades, and the Trump administration has made or proposed cuts to everything from special education to mental health, which falls under the ADA, in an effort to shrink the federal government and save money. Joining us now is Jordan Ballinger, policy director with Disability Rights Ohio, a nonprofit that advocates for equal treatment for people with disabilities. Welcome to All Sides, Jordan.
Thank you for having me.
So the Americans with Disabilities Act was a landmark piece of legislation when it passed. Can you take us back to that time? What kind of protections weren't there before that the law put into place?
Well, I can take you back further in time to give a little bit of context as well. So there was a lot that led up to the ADA. It didn't just kind of happen in a vacuum in the 1990s. And oddly, I had never heard that clip before. And I've worked in the disability space for over a decade. So it was really cool to hear President Bush talk about not tolerating discrimination for people with disabilities. But leading up to the ADA, it was decades and decades of fighting for equal access for people with disabilities, going back really kind of the biggest push in terms of people with disabilities advocating for equal access being in the 70s and the 504 protests in San Francisco in the federal buildings with people like Judy Heumann and Ed Roberts, who set up the first Center for Independent Living in Berkeley. And what they were really wanting was for the amendments to the Rehabilitation Act to be enforced. That was signed by President Nixon. And the hope was, and what the bill had anticipated, was any entity that received federal funding would have to access or grant access and be accessible for people with disabilities. There was not enforcement of this. Places like libraries were still very inaccessible. Schools were still very inaccessible. Mm-hmm. And so people, disabled advocates specifically, began protesting and working to make this a reality. We deserve access to these institutions, transportation being another big one that people were unable to access. And then as time progressed, right, you have a lot of different historical moments that are occurring within the 70s and 80s. You have Geraldo Rivera, a Fox News commentator who investigated the Willowbrook State School in New York, which led to congressional investigations and hearings, which actually created our organization, Disability Rights Ohio, and similar ones around the country to investigate and monitor institutions that house people with disabilities and prevent abuse and neglect. And that led to a continuation of expanding in law what the rights of people for disabilities are, which surmounted in the 90s with the ADA. And I think where disability advocates specifically like to talk about the ADA is the ADA is a landmark piece of legislation. It has provided access to numerous things, including employment, to our schools, to our communities, public spaces. But really, at its core, it's a foundation. It's a first step. It's not necessarily where we need or want to be as a disabled community. But it was a huge decision insofar as it, for the first time, lamented in federal law, people have the right to live integrated in their communities. And then in 99, the Supreme Court upheld that in a decision known as Olmstead VLC, which stated that individuals have the right to live in the most integrated setting appropriate to their need. Mm-hmm. So really what this has culminated in over the past several decades has been this fight to really ensure states are funding home and community-based services, which are services people receive to live in the community, to ensure they're not being unnecessarily institutionalized, and ensuring that people are able to access what non-disabled people are able to access. Go to a coffee shop in the morning, which I did. Go to the library in the afternoon after work. Go to a pizza shop with for dinner. Go watch a movie, right? Mm-hmm. These are all the things everyone wants to do. But for people with disabilities, they're largely left out of that. And so the ADA has helped spearhead access for those kinds of things. But it's, like I said, it's just the beginning. There's still so much work to do. There are so many places that are still inaccessible. And there's still so many pieces of legislation and work that has been done to ensure full and equal access for people with disabilities.
The law from the 90s, the ADA, how does it define disability? Because the definition is actually much broader than I realized. I mean, you think one thing, but what is involved in the definition?
Disability is a very large umbrella. It encompasses a lot of different things. The ADA is one or more impairments. So essentially what that means in plain language is anything that is prohibiting you from fully accessing your day-to-day activities. So for instance, I wear glasses. Anyone who wears glasses, contacts, whatever, that is a disability. Anyone who has asthma, that is a disability. I think lesser known are things like people with psychiatric diagnoses. So mental health, that's a disability. Type 1 diabetes, that's a disability. It is a very large umbrella. I think from my own work, I've noticed people equate disability to very particular kinds of things. Typically, in conversations, it's like developmental disabilities people equate to disability, so Down syndrome, intellectual disability, or people with physical disabilities, like people who use a wheelchair. But it's much larger than that. And our work at DRO spans all of that, including in schools, including ensuring people have access to the community, and really ensuring all people with disabilities have equal access, regardless of what kind of disability it is.
At the time that the bill was signed 35 years ago, there were critics who spoke about the cost to implement it. It was vague, who was responsible for paying for it. And that's something that President Bush acknowledged at the time. But is that something that was ever rectified, or is it just gets figured out through pieces of litigation at a time?
That is one of the biggest, I guess you could say, barriers or downfalls of the ADA is there is not a real clear enforcement mechanism to this particular
kind
civil
of an
rights.
Unfunded mandate.
An unfunded mandate is a perfect way to put it. So, yeah, exactly. If a building is inaccessible, an individual will not be able to go into that building. Mm-hmm. And the way to rectify that is they, you know, litigate.
They have to widen the door. They have to add a ramp. Yeah.
So there are, it's not one of those things that, you know, the ADA passed and suddenly everyone has access to everything in the community. Mm-hmm. We're 35 years in and there are plenty of places, even here in Columbus. I lived in German Village. I love German Village. But that is an incredibly inaccessible part of the city for people with disabilities.
Ooh, those sidewalks. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And, it is difficult, I think, for places of public accommodation to make those changes. There is language in the ADA that talks about reasonable accommodation, right? So the point of that was to get to what you were stating, which is we understand there's a financial barrier, but you should still be doing everything you can within your capacity to ensure that access. And what we often talk about with state governments, federal governments, local municipalities, is you all have the ability to incentivize local businesses, incentivize local communities to become more accessible. And your carrot here is you have funding available to be able to do that. But what we see largely is governmental entities do not incentivize establishing more accessible buildings, and people do rely on needing to have a conversation with a business, needing to litigate with a business, which is not something I think people with disabilities should be in the position to do. We really, I think, as a community should be breaking down barriers collectively to allowing people with disabilities more access to services and supports, because they are a large portion of our population. In Ohio, it's like 14%. In Columbus, I think it's a little larger, closer to 20%. So this is a large group of people that have voting power, that go to businesses, that eat, that drink coffee, all of the things that anyone else would do. And ensuring access to that is an economic growth factor.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking today about the ADA and the status of disability rights under the Trump administration with Jordan Ballinger of Disability Rights Ohio. So I wanted to move into what's happening today. I just mentioned the Trump administration. They've proposed cuts or made some cuts to everything from special education to mental health care. This is in line with efforts to shrink the federal government and save money. Now, some of the changes are set to take effect down the road, initially timed for after the 2028 election. And you have said that it's been a lot of wait and see over the past few months. To see what will be put into place or what will happen. What does the wait and see situation mean to you?
It's the worst kind of situation, I guess. The Big Beautiful Bill Act had cut roughly $1 trillion in Medicaid expenditures starting in 2026 through 2036. Mm-hmm. What that means for people with disabilities is, especially those who rely on Medicaid to access services in their community, those services are optional. States do not have to provide home and community-based services. They actually apply to the federal government for a waiver to receive funding to provide those services to people in the state. So when you cut the Medicaid program, generally speaking, that's going to have an impact, and it could have a dramatic impact on those optional benefits that our Medicaid system here in Ohio provides. So we're looking at potentially, over the course of the next 10 years, cuts to a service system that people rely heavily on. And we're also looking at potential cuts to a system that our state legislature, just in the last budget, provided an additional over $1 billion for to increase wages for direct care workers. And all of these things are going to impact access and put more stress on these service systems that so many of us have worked to alleviate. And what this would mean is people could be unnecessarily institutionalized. People could go days without care. People could be left at home without the direct care workers they need. People could be going hours without access to something that they rely on. And that's something that would not be great for people with disabilities. It goes against the grain of this history we have had of inclusion, of fighting for inclusion, of ensuring people have access. And so these cuts could have a really dramatic effect on how people just live their day-to-day life. We saw this before the last budget, what the direct care workforce crisis looked like and how it was impacting people. I don't think that's a situation we want to go back to. And if there are large-scale cuts to the program, it might get worse than what we saw prior to the last state budget.
But all of this is a wait and see, because the cuts don't really go into effect until 2028. But states have the ability to make up some of it, but they also don't know how much they're getting from the federal government. So are we kind of in an unknown holding pattern here, because we don't know exactly what's going to happen? It's not really spelled out.
Exactly. We don't know very specifically what the cuts are going to look like, right? We don't know how much funding is going to be removed from these state systems. We don't know what services the state will end up cutting. We don't know a lot of things at the moment, but we do know what the impact would be. And I do think there is some fear ingrained into this thought of what could happen. Essentially, what we would probably ask for, what advocates would end up doing, is going back to the state legislature and saying you need to put more of your own general revenue fund to support these service systems, which is kind of what they have been doing historically, right? Our legislature has committed a lot of money to the home and community-based service system. But as we saw in the last budget, there is also concern from the legislature as in this budget this year, about Medicaid funding from their perspective. They have trigger language in for the Medicaid expansion population if the federal matching rate drops. And so what we would see potentially is if cuts to Medicaid happen, the amount of federal money could be reduced. The state may not be able to give additional money, which means that's when they would need to start cutting services. And that would be where the real problem lies.
And the state also wants to add work requirements for some Medicaid recipients. But would people with disabilities be exempt from the work requirements?
Well, it goes back to our original discussion earlier, which was what is disability?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it does carve out particular kinds of people with disabilities, particular kinds of diagnoses, but it doesn't necessarily mean everyone with a disability who is on the Medicaid rolls are not going to be subjected to a work requirement. So I do think there's still going to be an impact regardless. From our perspective, though, right, people who are on these home services, home and community-based service waivers, that's where a dramatic effect could be. The expansion population, this trigger language that's been talked about a lot in Ohio, the concern there is specifically around the mental health piece.
Mm-hmm.
I think billing is around 47% of that population bills specifically for behavioral health. And so if funding is completely cut from that 700,000 grouping, then that is a lot of people that are no longer accessing mental health services and supports, which for me is appalling, as people deserve the right to access these services. So that's where there's a lot of nuance within the system, right? The Medicaid system is a very complicated system, but it provides a lot of benefit to people with disabilities and access. And so as we see funding change, we could potentially see some pretty dramatic shifts in how people with disabilities interact with the service system.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And coming up, Jordan Ballinger of Disability Rights Ohio is staying with us. And we're going to talk more about how mental health and special education fit into the ADA. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We're talking this hour about disability rights with Policy Director of Disability Rights Ohio, Jordan Ballinger. Thanks again for being with us.
Absolutely.
And we have been talking about changes, potential changes at the federal level, which are still being worked out, and what's happening at the state level, the recent 2-year budget passed. And we were just discussing what the recent 2-year budget does for people with disabilities, but the proposed changes to Medicaid are wide-ranging, have a lot of implications. I wanted to talk about how mental health fits into this conversation, because I think that many of us, you know, we were talking about the definition of disability in terms of physical disabilities or intellectual disabilities, because that's what most people think of. But what parts of mental health care fit under the ADA or under disability?
The simple answer is all of it.
Mm.
The complicated answer is, how do these service systems look, work, and play? And, you know, we talked a lot about the potential federal cuts to service systems, and obviously cuts to Medicaid impact our mental health service system, because there are a lot of people who are on the Medicaid rolls that bill for behavioral health specifically, which means they're just getting mental health services. And, you know, this particular system, going back a little bit to the history, has a really long storied history in Ohio, dating back to the founding, right? That's when the first what we now know as asylums were built. Mm. And then you have people like Dorothea Dix who lobbied the state legislatures to build these kinds of things. You had the Quaker movement that was looking to provide a more holistic care system because otherwise people were kind of in jails, poor houses, left on the streets, not really taken care of. Then you have Clifford Beers, who founded what's now known as Mental Health America, who started to advocate for community-based, what was then determined as outpatient treatment. And then in Ohio, the history is really profound when it comes to this particular system, because we, in specifically the 60s, there was a lot of research around how to effectively provide services to people with mental health diagnoses. And so in the 60s, you have what's known as the Horn Report that came out. And that report called for county-level administration of services, which led to the legislation that created our Boards of Developmental Disabilities, Adam H. Boards, which created in the 60s a system that still exists today, where they're able to leverage local levy dollars or tax dollars to provide services to people in that community.
So each county can put a levy on the ballot to have money to help pay for helping people with developmental or other kinds of disabilities.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
And obviously there, you know, in the statute and in these boards, there's a differentiation between intellectual, developmental, and mental health, which we see a lot. But a lot of it is also co-occurring, right? People mm-hmm. don't necessarily just live in one perfect box. I myself have several different disabilities that fit all kinds of different boxes. So people with developmental disabilities may also have a psychiatric diagnosis. Mm. But in terms of what does this and where is the problem that lies with current proposals? And the current state budget that was recently passed provides a lot of new funding to this service system, but historically, it has not been funded. So if you look at the landmark legislation in 1988, which is known as the Mental Health Act here in the state of Ohio, that was really meant to shift funding from institutional settings into the community and follow the person specifically so that that individual would be able to get complete wraparound services. By 1991, there was a report that was released that said, the money is not following the people. We don't have enough money. The service capacity is limited. If you look at testimony from this budget, from behavioral health advocates, you will see the same kind of argument. Capacity is limited. We don't have enough providers. Mm-hmm. We cannot serve everyone that we need to. The state has not made the kinds of investments it needs to really establish a holistic, well-working mental health service system. And so what has occurred over the past 20 or so years is a shift in how people are trying to solve this problem. And so what we have seen is legislation around expanding what's known as involuntary commitment, which is the forcing people into treatment through pink slipping or otherwise. And why that is necessarily important is because people are looking to use that as an opportunity to get people into treatment, but it also removes the rights of people, specifically because they have a disability. And why that's important today is because the president issued an executive order recently this year that called for the expansion of force. And the reason why it's so problematic is because it puts people, and what he's calling for is putting people specifically into institutions. And what mm-hmm. we're seeing from a lot of politicians today and what we're hearing is we need to go back. We need to rebuild these places. We need to put people back into these large warehouses that we have worked as a disability advocacy community to remove, to break down, to get people out of so that they can live independently in places they want to in the community. And this executive order kind of harkens back to that really scary history. And what we're hoping and what we're trying to advocate for is expansion of those services through things like Medicaid, through things like the state's GRF. And there are ways to go about doing this, but I think those messaging, mm-hmm. the message that is coming from a lot of these electeds is stigmatizing, and it can really have detrimental effects on legislation down the road.
A few months ago, Republican candidate for governor Vivek Ramaswamy posted on Facebook, this was back in February, that he wanted to bring back mental health institutions so that jails are not the front lines of psychiatric care. So basically, he's saying that people are being arrested and they're put in jail, and there's then like where the jails are having to deal with where to put them because these institutions don't have enough room. And so he's saying that we need to build this back up. And it relates to what you were saying about with the Trump administration. A part of his executive order was a move, and it's related to mental health and the homeless, just to it's kind of like to get them off the streets and put them somewhere. So if there's not enough places to put them, then what do we do? I guess there's, what's the plan?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And what I see here is myself and the gubernatorial candidate, right?
Mm-hmm.
We see the same problem, but how we solve the issue, I think, is different.
Mm-hmm.
From a public policy standpoint, it is more effective and more cost-effective for the state to do what it was hoping to do back in 1988, which is ensure services are in the community. That has not been fully seen. Cuts from the federal government have also impacted that, dating back to the 80s. And it really is incumbent upon the state government to ensure jails are not a mental health service provider. That's not their role. It shouldn't be their role. That's what mental health services are for and service providers are meant to be doing. So the state really has a responsibility here to commit additional funding. And there are ways to do this that are more streamlined, more specific, and can help communities themselves really address the situation. One thing that we have been working on pretty intensely over the past several years is a community response systems. So having the state fund localities to ensure that they can build out responses where it's not necessarily a law enforcement officer that's going out to do wellness checks, domestic violence, those kinds of things, but it's a social worker, it's a peer supporter. And then followed up by that is a recovery services supporter that helps them connect to housing and treatment and those kinds of things, right? That's the approach that has been talked about since the 60s that needs to be implemented, but it has not seen that fruition in this state.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about disability rights with Jordan Ballinger, Policy Director at Disability Rights Ohio. I think we could probably do an entire hour just on this topic, but I did want to move on before we run out of time, because I think a lot of people aren't aware that special education fits under ADA legislation and disability rights as well. I think a lot of people think special education is something the schools deal with and maybe the federal government through the Department of Education. But tell me how special education fits in as well.
Well, obviously, kids have disabilities and mm-hmm. they need to be supported in their schools to be able to transition into adulthood, college, the workforce, whatever, mm-hmm. right? And, I actually just heard a statistic. We came back from D.C., earlier this week, meeting with our congressional members, and we heard from one of our federal partners about how the funding for education of people, of students with disabilities, has been so historically low.
Mm.
And it has also been another one of those service systems that has not been fully funded or realized. And so how that interplays with the ADA is the ADA obviously talks about in 504 access to these public spaces, public accommodations, but more importantly is the IDEA, which is Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. That particular piece of legislation is what established the need to ensure students with disabilities have access to services and supports. Again, though, as I feel like I'm, repeating myself over and over again, it has not been fully realized. The funding has not been there. And students with disabilities do not get the services they need. And what we see is they don't succeed. They're not successful in school. They don't get to go out and do the kind of jobs and career placements and college placements that they want to do. And it's because we're not providing them the level of services they need. So how does that interplay with the federal government?
Yeah.
Recently, there was an article in Disability Scoop that talked about how the federal government is starting to withdraw grants to states because how our federal system works is there's a lot of carrot and stick action, right? Mm-hmm. And when it comes to disability systems specifically, there's a lot of federal grants that go out, and then states kind of have the strings to really move those policies. And they're announcing that they're going to begin removing what's already limited funding to the states, which will have an impact on what schools or local districts will be able to provide to students with disabilities, which means the success rate for students with disabilities is going to drop further because they're not receiving the services and the supports in the schools they need to be successful.
And either the state or the school district will have to pick up the bill if they're not getting as much federal funding.
Correct, because a lot of this goes back to the free and appropriate public education piece under the IDEA, which every student has a right to. However, the issue is schools do not have funding to fully realize that what's called FAPE, that FAPE piece. And so what I think we'll see, or what could happen with the reduction in this funding, is schools are going to reduce the services that they can provide, which is not good by any means, because we want students, and you know, the governor talks about this a lot as children being his kind of core policy piece. Students need to thrive in the state, and they should have everything available to help them thrive. And it is incumbent upon our governments, federal, state, and local, to ensure students with disabilities are able to get those services.
One thing I wanted to end on with you is there was a piece written for the Center of American Progress this summer, and it was called Politicians Don't Understand Disability. And there was a sentence in it that struck me. The author wrote, "If you're privileged to live long enough, you will end up with some disability." And that really made me stop and think, because there's a lot of people who don't realize that something exists until it impacts them directly. What do you think of that sentence, where if you're privileged to live long enough, you will end up with a disability?
It's true. It's the only class of people where at any point in time in your life you can fall into. And the point about politicians not understanding is so true. We see this every day, that politicians try to make decisions that are best for people with disabilities, but they don't include people with disabilities in the conversation. And how can you build out a service system without including those individuals? And also, there are very few elected members of our General Assembly, of Congress, of our local municipalities that are also people with disabilities, right? One of the only that has really identified herself as a person with a disability is Representative Christine Cockley. And she brings that perspective to the legislature and has proposed legislation around disability issues. But we're, as a community, constantly fighting to have our voices heard from people who don't necessarily fully understand what it means to live with a disability. And they also don't understand that it is a class of people that they could become a part of at any time. And ensuring places are accessible for all, that housing is accessible, affordable, that transportation is accessible, that access to home and community services should be available. They don't realize that there could come a time when they will have to need that, when they will have to access that. And investing now ensures that in the long term, those service systems will be available, not just for them, but their future generations and people after. And everyone deserves access to their communities. And it's incumbent upon politicians, I think, to really lean in and empower people with disabilities to come to the table, talk about these issues, and help craft better service systems so that we can actually support people with disabilities.
You've been listening to Jordan Ballinger, Policy Director at Disability Rights Ohio. Thank you for your time today, Jordan.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, the city of Columbus recently expanded its ADA efforts and dedicated a full-time person to the work and named 11 residents to a new commission. We'll learn more when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
It's rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This year, the city of Columbus hired a full-time person as its ADA coordinator, and it created a commission on disability issues with 11 members of the public, as well as representatives from different city departments. We've been talking this hour about the Americans with Disabilities Act, which just turned 35, and the state of disability rights here in Ohio. Joining us now is Angie Wise, the city's new ADA coordinator. Welcome to All Sides, Angie.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you took your position in January, and the city did not have a full-time ADA coordinator before you, but... Well, they had one, but it was not a full-time position. So what made the city decide to make it a full-time job, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Sure.
Yeah.
So the ADA states that all public entities with 50 or more employees are required to designate a person to coordinate ADA compliance efforts. And if you meet enough ADA coordinators, you will find that a lot of them are doing the position in addition to other responsibilities that mm-hmm. they have as well. My direct supervisor, Zane Jones, held the position prior to me in addition to Veterans Services Coordinator. And so after strategic guidance from the mayor and interactions with advocates and residents, you know, the city really acknowledged that residents with disabilities in Columbus deserve to have someone dedicated full time to this issue. And so that's how my mm-hmm. position became.
Tell us a little bit about this Columbus Advisory Commission on Disability Issues, because it was a committee before, and now it's been elevated to a commission. So what's the difference between a committee and a commission, I guess?
Yeah. So the committee has been doing the work of advocacy for decades, and it's really because of all of those people's efforts that in the summer of 2025, the committee was codified into code and became a commission. And through that, all city departments are required to name a department representative to the commission. They are a non-voting member. And then 11 members of the community were selected to be commissioners. And I would like to acknowledge that Jordan actually served as the chair of that committee and really helped to kind of shepherd in the recommendations that the committee made to have the commissioners appointed. Hmm.
So can you give us some examples of the work the city has done recently to comply with ADA requirements, to ensure disability rights? What are some noticeable changes that have happened in the city?
Absolutely. My role is under Title II of the ADA. So there's 5 titles. Title II states that it prohibits discrimination on the basis of disability for all programs, activities, and services of public entities, and that includes state and local government. So we are required as a local government to ensure that we're providing reasonable modifications, we're ensuring public accessibility, we're communicating effectively with people with disabilities. So there has been a lot of focus on looking at the built environment and making sure that people can access, you know, City Hall when they're coming in to attend a city council meeting. Once they're in that meeting, that we are providing closed captioning for people to use as well. My favorite department, other than Human Resources, which is where I'm housed, is the Department of Neighborhoods. They offer Rise Up C-Bus events throughout the summer. And so we want to ensure that people are able to access those events, that there's accessible parking, there are accessible restrooms that are available when they attend those events.
Yeah, and I also have a few examples written down here. There's an adaptive sports complex with wheelchair basketball.
Yes. I was so excited to be able to attend. It was recently they completed their dedication ceremony. It's called the ESPY Adaptive Sports Complex. That is the house of, they house the Therapeutic Recreation Program, which offers modified therapeutic recreation activities to people with disabilities. So yeah, as you said, they have wheelchair basketball. They also have an adaptive fitness center. So I am really excited that the city has that center available.
I would have to think with the ADA passing 35 years ago, something like making sure City Hall is accessible was probably done years ago, right? Being able to, everyone can open the door, everyone can, you know, get through the door, use the restrooms, that kind of thing. Are there more things that have come up in recent years? I guess maybe offering closed captioning online and in the meeting. That sounds newer to me.
Yes, and certainly offering a virtual option as well, which kind of was necessary during COVID for anybody to have access to meetings where we weren't able to attend in person. But yeah, now being able to offer that, that is certainly an accessibility aspect.
Are there things that still come up, though? I mean, do you get people contacting you and saying, you know, this part of, I had trouble in this part of City Hall, and you're surprised because it's, ADA has been around for 35 years?
Well, I wish I could say I was surprised, but I'm not. And I certainly do get people that contact me regarding accessibility issues. And sometimes that's through Title II and the accessibility of the city, and sometimes that's through different titles, which I'm happy to share information with them. But I would like to say, if someone does come across an accessibility issue throughout the city, to please submit a 311 request. That is the way the city is tracking when we need to address something that comes up.
So what would someone be able to submit through 311 if they are traveling down the sidewalk and they find a place in the sidewalk they can't get through?
If a construction equipment is blocking a curb ramp and they're not able to access that curb ramp, yep, such as this.
What are some efforts you've seen at the state level that have been helpful? There's the Opportunities for Ohioans with Disabilities, which can help with jobs. Is there state money for your department, or is it all city?
Mine is all city, but I do work very closely with the state ADA coordinator, and Governor DeWine has named Ohio a disability inclusion state. So, you know, as we're talking about state budgets, they actually, Opportunities for Ohioans with Disabilities, saw an increase in their budget, and they were able to hire another accessibility specialist for their Accessible Ohio. That program offers resources to individuals with disabilities, employers, in an effort to expand accessibility and inclusion throughout the state.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the Americans with Disabilities Act with the City of Columbus's ADA coordinator, Angie Wise. There's been a lot of work around the city to make ADA compliant sidewalks. In my neighborhood, Clintonville, there's been a lot of improvements to curb cuts. Curb cuts is whenever, or maybe you explain what a curb cut is. Can you tell me?
It's in the public right of way when you're going to cross a street.
Right. And so it's to make the curb go down low enough that it's not a step up, right?
Correct.
Yeah. You know, my neighborhood has seen lots of new curbs, new ramps on just about every corner, but not everyone is happy with it. The German Village Society recently sued the city of Columbus for removing historic bricks in the sidewalk to make these ADA compliant curb cuts. In your position, are you involved with these curb projects?
Not directly, no. That's more the Department of Public Service. I am very much aware of the conversation that is happening, but no, I'm not directly.
Okay. So in German Village, the German Village Society basically is saying that they understand the need for these, but they want the bricks to match and the curbs to match. So are you aware at all of the lawsuit or anything of how to, like, go forward?
Yes, I am aware of the discussion.
Yeah.
I think that this is something that the Columbus Advisory Commission on Disability Issues, I think that in the future we are going to have discussions about that, as well as how we can communicate with German Village and explain that, you know, certainly while we want to preserve historic places, that it's important that people be able to get to those historic places. And if you don't have a curb cut out for someone with mobility issues to be able to access it, then they're not going to be able to get there.
How do we decide whether, like, being declared historical and that the historic landmark law or the ADA compliance, do they have to meet in the middle, or does one trump the other?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, and so I think that it will. We're going to have to see how this conversation continues, but I hope certainly, you know, that people take into account how important it is for places to be accessible to people.
Do you hear a lot about the accessibility of businesses? I mean, I know you work for the city, mm-hmm. but can someone report to you if a business is not accessible?
I do hear a lot about accessibility of businesses. That would be under Title III, which is public accommodations such as restaurants, movie theaters. So when I get that information, I kind of talk through the ADA with people and what is legally required because it's a law, and then provide them with usually the ADA information line, which they can call. It's an anonymous line, and they can ask someone from the DOJ, you know, hey, this is what I experienced. Am I able to file a complaint or not?
I guess in having a title like ADA coordinator would make people think that they can ask you anything about all of the different topics.
Yes, it does. They do. Yeah. But again, you know, I'm happy to share information where I can and get them pointed to the correct resource to help them address their need.
Do you hear more about businesses, sidewalks? What's the thing you hear about the most?
I hear about scooters.
Tell me more.
Scooters, yeah. Blocking sidewalks is the primary communication that I receive via email and by phone. And, you know, the city of Columbus is addressing that. If someone comes across a scooter, please use that 311. You can submit a request online or you can call, and then the scooter company is required to respond to that.
So the scooter company could come out and move it.
Yes.
But then we actually did a whole show on scooters. And from the Department of, is it Public Service?
Yes.
The Department of Public Service came on and said that you actually, if you don't park your scooter correctly, you get charged more. Like, you're supposed to take a picture of how you park it.
Yes.
So is that helping, or is you're still getting a lot of scooter calls?
I think so. You know, and I think that it's one of those things that's going to take time to see the outcome of that. But certainly we're trying to do a lot of education around that and raising people's awareness of making sure that we're not blocking sidewalks for people to get through.
Or how much time do you spend watching budget hearings at the state and federal level? Because it seems like it seems like you're well supported. Probably there's never enough, but well supported by the city. Do you have any worries about state or federal changes when it comes to funding and what's needed with the ADA?
So I certainly do spend time watching those budgets and paying attention and trying to see like what's coming down the pipeline, because I think that someone that's in my position needs to be aware of all that. But my focus is on the day-to-day of the city government and making sure that we are improving accessibility for our residents.
And the city is funding your part, right? You said that it's not really the state doesn't require this. It's the city thing.
Correct. Yes.
So earlier in the hour, we talked about a piece that was recently published about disability awareness. And it was about, basically the title was What Politicians Don't Understand About Disability. And in it, the author wrote that if you're privileged to live long enough, you'll end up with some disability. What do you think people should be aware of if they don't have a disability, but maybe they're not aware of what they need to know just around the city when it comes to disability?
Yeah, well, I think with that quote, you know, as we age, we might develop a chronic health condition that results in a disability. There might be a traumatic event where we develop a disability. There's a lot of invisible disabilities as well that people might have. And so I heard Jordan's answer about politicians, and I think that Columbus has taken the step to, you know, name department representatives to the Columbus Advisory Commission on Disability Issues, and we lovingly refer to it as CACTI. And then CACTI has been charged with reporting to city council and the mayor and other governments the issues that they feel that people with disabilities are addressing. So even though we're just kind of in our infancy stages, we just had our leadership elected, we're working on the bylaws, and we're getting ready to set our strategic plan. I'm very hopeful about what this group of very passionate commissioners is going to bring forward to the table.
We have about 1 minute left. Tell me what the first duty of this new commission is going to be.
I think it's going to be communicating with the city and reviewing, you know, the policies and procedures just to ensure that everyone has access to all of the city programs, activities, and services.
So, and that you mentioned that the commission has 11 members. Mm-hmm. They've already been appointed and they're working on a strategic plan. If someone listening right now wants to contact someone on the commission or just like, you know, get their input in for the strategic plan, how would they do that?
If you go to columbus.gov and you can either in the search type in ADA or Columbus Advisory Commission on Disability Issues, that will pull up the landing page and all of the contact information will be there. And they can also reach out to me as well.
Okay. We've been talking with the City of Columbus's ADA coordinator, Angie Wise. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
This has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. If you missed any part of today's conversation, remember you can listen at our website, wosu.org/allsides, subscribe to the podcast, or listen in the WOSU mobile app. Also, be sure to follow the show on Facebook, and we also have the show on Instagram at AllSidesWOSU. I want to say thank you to our producers, Marcus Charleston and Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, and our students, Iza Huck and Colin Simpson. Video production by the Ohio Channel, board operation by Chris Johnston and Cameron Howard. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.